So then we move to item four, which is an informational item. And so, Mr. Robinson, would you please introduce that item?
Thank you, Chair Wolf. So at a February board meeting, I initiated a concept of strategically themed board meetings. That one was environmental justice. Continuing with that concept and harnessing an idea shared by a board member, we're theming this meeting as a state of water quality in the region, specific state of surface water quality throughout the region. In May, we'll follow with a state of groundwater quality conditions throughout the region. And through these two items, we're setting the table informationally prior to providing the board with a menu of regulatory options or directions for Ag Order 4.0. It's kind of the initial framing of 4.0. Additionally, this status of water quality regional assessment also helps frame discussion of other priority surface and groundwater related issues and sources for future actions. Specific to item four summarizes the surface water quality conditions in the Central Coast through a total of 7 presentations provided both today and tomorrow. This item is not intended as a discussion of how potential elements of Ag Order 4.0 might address these conditions. We're not prepared to do so, nor is this item agendized as such. The board can provide staff with direction as it pertains to Ag Order 4.0, but we're not going to counter-engage on that issue too much. With that, I'll hand it over to Section Manager Chris Rose, who is the Irrigated Lands Program Manager.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Good morning, Chair Wolf, and members of the board. And I'm Christopher Rose, Irrigated Lands Program Manager at the Central Coast Water Board. As Mr. Robinson said, we have seven speakers with this item, and this morning we are going to have 3 speakers speaking. The first one is Dr. Luo. He is with Department of Pesticide Regulation. And Dr. Luo is going to be talking about modeling pesticide application and predicting the risk with that modeling tool. After Dr. Luo, we're going to have Dr. Deng speak. He's also with Department of Pesticide Regulation. And Dr. Deng is going to be talking about current pesticide occurrences that we see in our receiving waters here in the Central Coast region. After Dr. Bill, we're going to have Dr. Brian Phillips with UC Davis. He's with Granite Canyon, and he's going to be talking about toxicity and pesticide trends in surface waters, as well as test organisms used for that toxicity indication. So without further ado, we will get to our speakers.
And I just want to mention that I believe you have the presentations in your folders for today's first 3 speakers. Do you have all of them?
So if Dr. Luo could come to the microphone.
From here? Next. Do you have the control for the slides?
Thanks for the introduction. This is Yuzo Luo from DPR, and today I'm going to introduce the surface water monitoring prioritization model and with its applications to the Central Coast. This model is developed as a computer program to prioritize pesticides of interest as area of interest for surface water monitoring. So basically, it's designed to answer some basic questions for the pesticide monitoring, such as when to sample, where to sample, and what to sample. This model is developed and optimized for DPR, but during the development, we had communications with water boards and other agencies, including US EPA, to make sure their comments are incorporated into the model development. The modeling tool and the documentations are available in DPR's surface water models webpage. The latest version is the version 4, which is not yet uploaded in the website, but you should already have that. This is the graphic user interface. As you can see, there are three sections for the model inputs, including the basic configuration, advanced option, and watershed delineation. So in the first section, the most important thing is the pesticide use pattern. This is consistent to DPR's monitoring projects. We have pesticide monitoring projects for agriculture and for urban, which are separated projects. So as you can see, we also have the option for crop-specific pesticide prioritization. This is requested by US EPA when they are working on some very specific project, such as the rice pesticide. And this is for the PUR data. We usually use the most recent 3 years of PUR data. And this time, the most recent year with PUR data available is the 2015. And the new data will be available soon. And at the end of this panel is the toxicity data. We usually use the US EPA aquatic benchmark and also with the additional data from the IUPAC footprint database. And you can select acute toxicity, chronic toxicity, or the lowest one from those two values. In the advanced options, you can have a more refined selection of the pesticide prioritization, such as some specific county, months, and monitoring data, or some options for the reporting. And currently, for the watershed prioritization, we have 3 options. The first one is called HAC-12-based prioritization. HAC-12 is the official USGS watershed delineation. So the entire United States is divided into a HAC-2 system. And in HAC-2 system, there are lower level watershed called HAC-4, then HAC-8, and so on. And this time, HAC-12 is the highest resolution officially released by USGS. If you don't like the USGS definition, or you have a better understanding of your local condition, you can use a customized watershed. And finally, we have the option for spatially continuous mapping. That means you can do the prioritization for all the watersheds in California. I will give an example for each of them. So let's use the modeling approach. We started with the PUR database, which stands for Pesticide Use Reporting Database, maintained by DPR. First, we get the pesticide use amount and aggregate them into the watershed scale. And then we calculate the pesticide routing and dissipation within the stream network. NHD stands for the National Hydrograph Database, which is basically the upstream and downstream relationship. And finally, we get the effective use of pesticide for each downstream site. Then the effective use is combined with the US EPA aquatic life benchmark to get the priority score. In addition to the pesticide use amount, there are other information in the PUR database, such as the pesticide product, pesticide application method, or use patterns. So with those data combined with the pesticide chemical property, we have another set of results called a monitoring recommendation. That means we have the recommendation which chemical is recommended for monitoring or not recommended for monitoring. So in summary, for the modeling inputs, we have the PUR database, the chemical property database, and the toxicity database. And for the modeling results, we have the priority score, which is called the preliminary priority list. And then we have the refined priority list. So let's use the approach used for the pure data aggregation and watershed scale. For agricultural uses, it's relatively easy because the agricultural PUR is originally in section level. Section is the 1 by 1 square mile. So we can just get the pesticide use within each watershed. And by the way, we have 4,400 watersheds in California. For the urban pesticide use, it's slightly different because the urban PUR is authorized as a county level. So for the conversion, we introduced the population density as the intermediate resolution to convert the county-based PUR into the watershed PUR. So the basic assumption is that urban pesticide use is proportional to the population density. And by the way, in this model, we define the urban use as the structural pest control and the landscape maintenance uses. So as mentioned before, the HAC 12 watershed is the minimal spatial resolution. That means there is no internal structure or internal variation within each HAC 12 watershed. So this is just like your pixel on your screen, which is the minimal unit for display. So that means there is no way to make difference between two sites within each watershed. The only thing we can do is to introduce the flow accumulation. So the model actually can be used to separate the mainstream sites compared to the tributary sites, because the tributary sites only get the contribution from the local watershed, but the mainstream monitoring sites will get contribution not only from the local watershed, but also from the upstream watersheds. And here's the shows the option in the model. So you can see that this site is located on the mainstream, which receives water from upstream watersheds. There are two basic functions in this model. The first one is called site-specific prioritization. That means you have a predefined monitoring site or monitoring network, and the model will provide you a list for the pesticide for sampling. This is an example for the DPR monitoring site and the lower Salinas River, and more information are provided in the DPR monitoring study protocol. So as you can see, based on this predefined monitoring site, the model will provide you a list of the chemicals for the sampling, and which is sorted by the final score, which is the production of the use score and toxicity score. And we also have another list called the monitoring inclusion. So we will give a reason for each of the chemicals not included in the DPR's monitoring, such as we don't have the auditing method, or this chemical is not recommended by the model. We will provide a specific reason why we not include this chemical in the DPR monitoring. The second function is called spatially continuous mapping. So if the site-specific prioritization is to answer the question when and what to sample, and this function is to answer the question where to sample. So basically, for the chemical interest, the model will provide you a list of the area for the sampling. Here shows an example for the urban use of the bifencing. As you can see, the map shows some hotspots and the darker color for the higher priority. And I also shows the DPR monitoring size for the urban monitoring at this time. So as you can see, we generally covered the most of the hotspots in California. And this map also provides us some additional information for future development of additional sites. For example, we are thinking about some sites for the South Sacramento and maybe a Riverside. And as you can see, there are limitations for each of the basic functions. So for the site-specific prioritization, you have to predefine your monitoring site. And for the spatially continuous mapping, you have to predefine your chemicals. So what if we don't have any information? For example, if the DPR wants to develop a new project for North California, for example, so we are asked the same question. And recently developed a new function called AOI and POI determination, which is based on the two basic functions. So the basic approach is that we will run the model multiple times, and then we can determine both the chemical and the sampling area at the same time. So the potential application is that we can use this tool to develop a new monitoring projects, such as the DPR's new projects for the North California. And of course, we can evaluate and improve the existing monitoring network. And this example for the Central Coast. So the Central Coast in the model is defined hydrologically as the HAC 4 of the 1806, which is generally the same area of the Region 3. So first thing in the model, we define or select the use pattern for the agricultural use, and of course use the latest 3 years of PR data, and then we select the both or the lowest value of acute and chronic toxicity value for the as the toxicity benchmark. And then we can select choose this function, AOI PUI determination, and I choose the steps for this function. So first thing is to define your starting domain. You can select statewide or one or more HAC 4. So for this case, I just selected the Central Coast. And next slide, the model will run the site-specific prioritization to provide you a list of the chemicals recommended by the model. And you have the opportunity to select the chemicals for your monitoring. So here I just show example of the top 20 chemicals currently sampled by DPR. And of course, there is an option that you can manually add additional chemicals if the chemical is not in the list recommended by the model. And for example, we during our communication with Region 3, we decided that there are two more chemicals to be added in addition to the DPR's top 20. And I actually added those two chemicals into the model simulation. And the step number 3 is called HAC-8 analysis. So basically, based on the chemical you selected in the last step, the model will give you a list of the HAC-8 watershed for sampling. So you can select the watersheds, or you can add more watersheds here. And here I just select the top 3 for demonstration purpose. Once you select the, if you just the geographic location of those selected watersheds, as you can see, the Santa Maria, Monterey, and Salinas. Once you have your selected watersheds, the model will run for the final step, which is a HAC-12 analysis. So the model will provide a list of the watersheds for your consideration for the project development. As you can see, those are for each of the pre-selected watersheds. And there are some options. For example, you can select how many watersheds you want to consider in each HAC-8. And here I just use the top 3. And top 3 means that you have 3 watersheds, but also consider the tap of the midstream and the tributary. So that means at most you will have 6 watershed from the model, because the 3 watershed and the 2 of the stream taps. And there are other options. For example, there's a threshold by coverage for the relevant land use. Because this is for the agriculture monitoring, we prefer watersheds with at least some agricultural land use. So there is a threshold for like 20%. If any watershed with the agriculture land use less than 20%, it will not be listed by the model. And there is another very, very interesting concept called a relevant chemical. So because we are, at least for this example, we are more interested in the chemical pesticide uses, agricultural uses. So if at watershed, at each of the watershed, the other use pattern, such as urban use, is significant, then this chemical may not be included in your monitoring. So if we just give an example here, 2008, this is a permethrin. That means for permethrin, which may be significant in this watershed, but it's, So it's significantly contributed by the urban sources. So you may consider your sampling plan, but it's really based on your field condition. For example, you can just select a specific portion of the watershed with only the agricultural uses. So this is just warning information. Doesn't mean you cannot sample those chemicals. And this is just a summary of the results. The first three columns are just taken from the modeling results. And the last one is I manually added for something like the model validation. So I just want to make sure those model recommended watershed are actually under our monitoring, either the history monitoring or the current active monitoring. So it seems that except one watershed, most of the model recommended watershed are under either the historical monitoring or the active monitoring by DPR or the Water Board. And here shows a map for the model recommended watersheds. So as you can see, most of the watersheds are covered by the DPR size or the downstream of the DPR size. And here the Salinas and Santa Maria. Just some quick notes. So this demonstration only shows the results for the top three watersheds in each of the top three HAC-8s. But you can actually select all the HAC-12 in all the HAC-8s. And actually, I provided the results for all of the HAC-12s in the Central Coast. And the model only ranks the watersheds within each HAC-8, but not between different HAC-8s. So that means this is actually not one list, but three separate lists for each of the HAC-8s you selected. So basically, we want to sample the worst-case condition, but also consider the spatial variation. For example, if we do the statewide prioritization for urban pesticides, maybe the most of the top sites will be the South California. But that doesn't mean we cannot sample the North California. So we want to keep both the prioritization and also the spatial variation or the representation for different regions. So, but the regional ranking or statewide ranking can be done manually with the full modeling results provided before. More considerations. So the modeling results just provided you a short list for the candidates of the chemicals and the monitoring size for the for consideration for the sampling, but there are some gaps between the modeling results and your final monitoring projects. So for example, there are additional considerations and to define or to finalize your study plan. So actually, I forgot to put it here. We have an SOP recently established to explain how to use the modeling results and to finalize your monitoring study plan. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. At this time, before the next speaker, I'd like to ask my colleague if anyone has any question.
Sure.
While your presentation is fresh in everybody's mind, a lot of information to assimilate. Dr. Hunter?
Thank you very much. And I agree, a lot of information, but a lot of progress showing with how we look at the data, the data we collect and how we collect it. So I'm gonna ask you a really simple question because your whole presentation revolved around the use of the HUC unit.
Yes.
And can you go through that one more time for me? Because I'm not certain I understand the levels of 4, 8, and 12. Mm-hmm. I think when you get to 12, it suggests to me that it is encompassing larger or perhaps whole large watershed units, and the smaller scale watersheds are encompassed in the 4 and the 8. I'm not sure. Did I get that?
Yeah, sure. I'll give a quick review of the USGS HAC system. HAC stands for the Hydrological Unit Code. So first thing is that the USGS divided the entire United States into the HAC 2 system, for example, the California is generally covered by HAC2 number 18. So California is one HAC2. And in each HAC2, there are lower level watersheds called HAC4. So in California, we have about 10 HAC4, and the Central Coast is one of the HAC4s, which is number 1806.
Okay.
And in each HAC4, there are even lower watershed delineation called HAC6, and then HAC8, and HAC10, and HAC12. HAC12 is currently the most highest spatial resolution officially posted by USGS. There are some unofficial definition called catchment, which is even higher resolution, but not yet the officially released by USGS. So basically, HAC12 is the highest resolution for the USGS watershed delineation, and there are more than 4,000 of the HAC12 in California.
Okay, that explains it for me.
Yeah.
So it's about the resolution has to do with the level of detail or the level of complexity that you could take into account.
Yes, yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Okay, and the 4,000 watersheds, it doesn't really have anything to do with watersheds and sub-watersheds, and it's that 1 by 1 mile?
No, that is a PUR reporting unit.
Okay.
It's called a section. It's called Township, Range, and Section, which is about 1 by 1 square mile.
Okay.
That is nothing to do with the watershed delineation, but used for the PUR reporting.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That puts the perspective I'm missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very good.
Any other Delgado?
Sure. Thank you for your presentation. I'm looking at the staff report, which summarizes a paragraph of your report today. In the last sentence, I had a question that says the monitoring studies are designed to detect higher levels of pesticide contamination, allowing for a conservative approach to pesticide risk assessment. What do you mean by conservative in that context?
For the monitoring project design, there are different expectations, at least between DPR and maybe water boards, maybe USGS. So DPR, we don't really do something like a statewide survey or background survey to do the pesticide monitoring in both the high use area or the low use area or even in the national parks. We only do the monitoring within the high pesticide use area. So that is something we call a conservative or worst case condition. We are not really interested in the spatial variation or spatial distribution. We understand that there must be lower concentration in time and space, but we want to use our limited resource to get the highest or more representative concentration within the high pesticide use area. That is what we are talking about here.
So conservative means focusing on the highest risk.
Highest use or highest concentration area. We could capture that.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Gray.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I appreciate the thoroughness of it. I just have a simple question on slide 9. When we're talking about the use scores and the toxicity scores, what are the upper and lower limits of those scores?
Let me just move it there. Yeah. So the use score is in the range from 1 to 5. And toxicity score from 1 to 8, but there is no upper limit for toxicity score because it's basically a log transformation of the benchmark value. 8 is the current highest value because we found that there is no the most toxic chemicals have a toxicity value which is 10^-8 ppb. So for use, this is 1 to 5, and for toxicity is 1 to whatever you have in your database.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So, also, thank you for your presentation. And, again, there was
quite a bit of information, so I have a couple of clarification requests. One, you know, you talked about in one of the in the modeling approach, you know, you had priority score. Here we go.
Yeah.
And then we had monitoring recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
And I need a little more clarification, because monitoring recommendation, is it monitoring based on quantitative and qualitative? And then if monitoring recommendation changes are made and implemented, then does it change the results comparison? Because part of modeling use is to make comparison, and I'll use an agriculture term, compare apple to apple. So if you make a change, you know, how does it impact your ultimately your evaluation? So it's a two-part question.
Okay, so basically, priority score is simply defined by only by use and toxicity. And but sometimes we found that some chemicals, the use amount may be huge, but the chemical may not or unlikely to cause a surface water problem because of something like a shorter persistence or the high vapor pressure or the some application methods with a very little chance to move into the water. That's why, in addition to the priority score, we have the monitoring recommendation. The recommendation is just very simple, recommend or not recommend. And for if a chemical is not recommended for monitoring, the model will give you the specific reason, such as the high vapor pressure or the lower aquatic persistence, and so on. So we because the priority score is a preliminary list of the priority, and the monitoring recommendation is refined. So and the monitoring recommendation is mainly related to the chemical property, and very important that is the application method. Each chemical, one chemical may be related to multiple pesticides or products. Each product is related to multiple application method in different region. The same chemical may be applied in totally different way. So that's why the monitoring recommendation may be different even for the same chemical, but in different region or different monitoring period. So it is possible that the monitoring recommendation may change from time to time, from space to space. But if it's defined, if you have a defined time and space, this recommendation will be fixed.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. The other one is you indicate that there is an adjustment in the model for urban population density.
Mm-hmm.
So if it is based on total population, say an area where you have 30,000 inhabitants versus 250,000, is the correlation of population density, shouldn't the correlation be more based on outdoor landscape? Because if you have high population density, my understanding is that houseplants have very little impact on surface water.
Mm.
But if you do have areas where you do have front lawns, backyard, obviously the issue of pesticide application is elevated.
Mm.
So, you know, you look at communities of Northern California, Southern California, and, you know, particularly in newer communities, you tend to have a higher density, you know, less square footage of property versus more long established property. So how do you manage that?
I totally agree that this assumption, the proportional to the, urban pesticide use proportional to the population is not a perfect assumption. And actually, the downscaling of the urban PUR is
is a pretty hard problem, not only for this model, but for a general model application and pure application. So at this time, we just give a rough estimation and try to downscale the pure urban PUR into the same resolution as the agriculture PUR use, but not really want to generate a higher resolution PUR database for urban use, which is a mission impossible. Because the original resolution is accounting-based, how can I do that downscaling into a section or one square mile level? So in addition to the population density, as you mentioned, we are also considering the land use data as another additional predictor for the downscaling. But still, the downscaling is really a rough estimation for the PUR database, but that is maybe the best available option for us because of the original PUR, urban PUR resolution, which is at the county level.
So, last question.
Yeah.
One of your slides, you indicated two more chemicals were added upon request by the Santa Cruz Regional Water Quality Control Board staff on 1/10/2018.
Mm.
And you named the two chemicals, and I don't want to embarrass myself, you know, pronouncing them. But, you know, the two multisyllable chemicals. So the question is a little bit of educational information, since this is an information item for everyone. What are the specific agriculture use of these two chemicals?
I can only give the explanation from the modeling viewpoint, but this question should be answered by the region 3, because I just got the request from them.
So
I think the original communication is that I provided the 20 top 20 chemicals currently sampled by DPR, and I sent the results. I mean the same actions to the region 3, and after the review the results, they said that maybe we should also consider those two additional chemicals. That's the story.
You know, so this is an informational item. You know, then I would like to ask staff to answer that question at this time. Because I'd like to know the rationale, you know, for adding these two chemicals. So one, what are their use? And question two, what triggered adding these two chemicals in your list? So Chris, maybe you can answer whoever. Thank you.
Good morning. Mary Hamilton, Central Coast Water Board. I am not the staff person who requested this. Peter Mertens, who is, you just heard from at the recent board meeting, he's our TMDL staff who is working closely with pesticides. I know that one of these is a fungicide, and so applied on all kinds of crops to avoid mold and fungal infection, but the methoxyphenoxide, I'm not actually familiar with, I'm sorry. But these are chemicals that we know are applied in our region, and Peter was the staff person who weighed in and requested that we add those to the other top 20 chemicals identified by the model.
Okay, so as a follow-up,
I can do the research really quick and get back to you within 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'd like to know because, when we add to already, a list of 20 chemicals that have been identified by DPR, there has to be a good reason, I'm sure.
Yes.
For adding these, and so I'd like to know, and often knowing the use of a pesticide helps understanding which crop these are applied. If we know which crop those are applied, we know if these are crop where we do have a lot of acreage planted or very little. So that's what's going through my mind.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate the...
If you give me just a few minutes, I have Peter on speed dial with my texting, and I'll get right back to you.
Sounds good. Thank you very much. And also, Dr. Liu, thank you for your presentation. I'm looking on my right here, and I do believe that Mr. Johnson has still...
I just have one brief question. I'm still trying to understand the HUX, the hydrologic units. And so I understand that sounds like they go in even numbers only, and that the bigger the number, the finer the resolution. I guess my question is, when you get down into the finer resolutions, the Hock 8s and 10s and 12s, are those of a relatively standard size, or do they vary dramatically in size because they're really based on watersheds, which of course vary dramatically in size?
The Hock 12 watersheds may have a dramatically different size. Some Hock 12 are much, much bigger than the other Hock 12s. It's mainly based on the flow accumulation and the flow direction. So there is no limit or the bound for each of the area of the Hock 12s.
So for all of the different Hock levels, they may vary dramatically in sizes.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Dr. Liu. I appreciated your presentation. That was very very informative and detailed. It takes a little bit of time to digest and comprehend. On a big scale, is your model then going to inform the work that Dr. Deng is doing?
Actually, currently the model is used by the DPR, at least for the surface water protection program, for the study and the monitoring project planning, not only for agriculture, but also for urban.
Okay. I think you mentioned something about version 4.0.
Yes.
Has not been released yet, but it's being reviewed?
It's not updated yet online, but I have no problem to send the model to upon the individual request. That's why I send that to the registry. I share that in online share drive.
But you do have a model, is it 3.0 or 3.5 that is in use?
We are using the latest version, 4. Version 4.
Okay.
Mm.
Yes, Jessica.
I might be able to explain. So they have 4.0 that they're using in-house, basically, that they've sent us the data for, but online, 3.0 is the latest version.
3.0.
So if you went online to look at it,
okay,
you would be seeing 3.0.
Okay. And so then my question is kind of also to staff. How is staff going to use this model and the information that gets generated?
Dr. Liu can speak to how he's already collaborated with Region 5 and they're using the model outputs in their monitoring. And we have already received results region-wide with the risk scores for each of our Hock 12s. We're currently using those to evaluate all of the watersheds in our region, and we're incorporating that into a prioritization matrix for every watershed so that we can identify places that are of highest risk, have high pest pollution problems, are of high value resources, so like areas that are designated as critical habitat or an estuary or flow into an estuary. So we're combining multiple factors, including the risk model outputs, into a prioritization matrix that can inform many things, including identifying areas where we want to do work sooner rather than later.
And where are you in that process?
We've pulled all the information together into the matrix, and internally staff still need to kind of vet the pieces of the matrix and decide what the most informative parts of that are. So it's very preliminary still, but we have pulled all the data together.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, can I ask a follow-up to that?
Sure.
I'm sorry. Is this new to you, or have you had a matrix and you're updating it?
So the matrix is new-ish. We've used something like it in the past, of course, because we've always had information that we're using in it, but this matrix is more robust, includes more things, and we're hoping to inform several actions of the Water Board using it.
All right, so do you use the final score to prioritize in the matrix, to prioritize implementation after you have the matrix? So, what are the considerations you have that drive your prioritization?
So right now we've kind of thrown everything we can think about it, so it's full of all kinds of information. But things like water bodies that, so resource value, water bodies that are designated critical habitat for fish species, estuaries, basin plan beneficial use designations, so water bodies that are cold or warm or spawning, information about data, so scores for each site and water body based on if they're on the 303D list for certain pollutants, if they have high concentrations of certain pollutants, if they have high loads of certain pollutants, and then also the DPR model outputs, the risk value is included in there as well. So we also have information about groundwater risk and data in the matrix now. So like I said, we kind of, so far we're putting everything in it, and we still need to vet it internally and decide what makes sense to inform prioritization. But things like that are what we're considering so far.
Might you include in that list of parameters that you use for prioritization up-and-coming pesticides, insecticides that...
Absolutely.
Okay. So which pesticides are being used is one of your considerations to prioritize as well?
Absolutely. And in fact, our recommendations for updates to the monitoring and reporting requirements will certainly be informed by the model outputs here and the top chemicals plus these two. And, of course, when we get there, we'll reevaluate with the most current data available, but that will certainly inform our recommendations as to what we should be monitoring. And perhaps if we decide that we want to do specialized monitoring in different areas, it might inform that as well, too.
Yeah, thank you.
It has many uses.
So I have a follow-up question on the follow-up question. You mentioned that, you know, the model, the new model has been used by the Central Valley region,
yes.
Correct? So have you communicated with the staff of the Central Valley region to see how they approach this, since clearly someone else has already dug into this information, and I always believe there is a lot of value of seeing what our region counterparts do?
I absolutely agree. I have not, and I don't know if staff has specifically talked to Region 5 staff yet about their use of the model. I'm just aware of their use in developing their current San Joaquin monitoring plan, for example. And we are not at the step yet where we're getting there in terms of our office, and that will certainly be part of our process. There's multiple inputs, especially from Region 5, what's working, what's not working, before we proceed.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Young?
Thank you. And so,
okay.
Thanks.
Maybe you can answer this with the model that we're talking about. We're talking about surface waters. Is the recommendation to, is it specific to monitoring simply water column? Does it include monitoring sediment?
So it would depend, right? Certain chemicals are, you're going to find them in sediment and not likely to find them in water unless there's a high sediment, suspended sediments in the water column, which would be transporting chemicals stuck to it. So yes, chemicals that are sediment bound, we would typically monitor those in sediment. And then water soluble chemicals, of course, we'd look to monitor those in the water column.
So in the slides that we just saw, is there anything there that pops out at some stage once you get a scoring of a chemical that should be monitored as to whether that's a sediment-bound chemical?
Yeah, so in the risk output, it's not there specifically, but that information is readily available. So we would evaluate that before we decide to recommend requiring monitoring for one chemical or another and in what matrix.
Do we do any monitoring of aquatic organism tissue for these chemicals? I know we do, you know, survival testing, acute toxicity testing, chronic testing. Do we ever go in and actually monitor tissue load?
So I don't believe DPR does. And CCAMP does not typically, nor does the Cooperative Monitoring Program for Agricultural do that type of monitoring, but the SMOP program, which is the umbrella surface water ambient monitoring program for the state, CCAMP is under the SMOP program, the regional arm of SMOP. There is a statewide study or statewide program under the SMOP program that specifically is about bioaccumulation. Off the top of my head, I don't know which chemicals they specifically monitor for, but there's a large technical advisory committee that advises the monitoring there, and I know that they're very interested in staying current with things that are likely to accumulate. So you may remember we had some data that showed that Osofalco Lake had the highest concentration of DDT in the state and, as far as we know, in the nation in fish tissue, and that came from that statewide study. And that study rotates between nearshore areas, lakes, inland, and then also some surface water monitoring, about a six-year rotation-ish. So there's some data, but not a lot.
Thank you.
You bet. And I just heard back from Peter, if I may.
Sure.
He just said that the methoxyphenol.
I call it the six-syllable and the five-syllable chemical.
I'm sure I'm butchering it too. I apologize. He said it's used on broccoli and it's specific to butterflies and moths. And then I already mentioned that the other is a fungicide, which is used on many crops where you want to prevent fungal and mold growth. He didn't say specifically, he said he's looking. So I would assume, I don't want to speculate. I think I know, but I'll wait till I get the answer.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, you asked why chemicals would be added to the list, and there's two main reasons why they would be added. In our monitoring and our research programs, if we start to see those chemicals in our region frequently, we would ask that those be added to the monitoring list. Or if we're reviewing the pesticide use reports and we find that they are being applied in larger quantities, we would ask that they be added to the list.
Yeah, my question was aimed around, you know, the trigger, just because there's a new product out there, and you know, every year chemical companies have, you know, the new and improved product is one thing, but you know, triggering the monitoring also should be based on amount of applications and the popularity of it, you know. And once in a while, you know, this is just personal, I have difficulties just with chemicals, because often I try to remember based on label and brands. And that's also because of the six-syllable issues. So I was trying to get my hands around these two chemicals.
Yeah, the pesticide use reports are great because they tell us how many pounds per acre are being applied and the mass amount that's being applied and where. And
so, but that gets also to a topic that, you know, we discussed briefly at our last brief, is that with climate change, we do have significant fluctuations increasingly of, you know, chemicals being applied. If we take, for example, fungicide, perfect example. If you have extreme drought years, the application is very, very limited. If you have very wet years, particularly toward springtime, with certain type of crop, you're going to have higher applications. So, you know, DPR report on sulfur is a perfect example where, you know, you get years where the total quantity used drops by a high percentage. Well, it has nothing to do with growers reducing the application as an effort to reduce the use of these products. It's just because it was not necessary to be applied on the crop. So, I'm sure you account for those changes ultimately when making evaluation of yearly use of various types of chemicals. And I'm making eye contact with Dr. Liu when I say that, right? Okay, so, Mr. Jones.
One more quick question. The pesticide use reports, just so I understand, those are filed with the County Agricultural Commissioner, and are those prospective or retrospective? In other words, are they what the farmer anticipates applying on the acreage, or what in the coming period, or what the farmer actually applied in the previous period?
I'm not an expert for that, but based on my understanding, I think for at least for the agriculture applications, those should be after each application, and then they submit the information to the accounting commissioners.
Okay, because I believe they used to be retrospective. I don't know if they are now. Or excuse me, prospective, that they would file in advance of what they intended to
yes.
apply.
The answer is, with a capital Y, yes. Because the Ag Commissioner takes the information. You know, anyone who is a pesticide applicator for commercial application has to be licensed and has to provide the reports to the Ag Commissioner. So then the Ag Commissioner aggregates the information, and that's basically the boots on the ground source of information.
So the reports are filed after the fact of the application?
In most cases, yes. And the reason I paused is that there are certain cases where you have to give an advance notice, depending on certain type of
right, you have to give advance notice of
right.
if it's near a school and this and that. But it's either filed right after the application.
But ultimately, yeah, what is being used as data is actual application and what is, you know, being considered to be future.
Okay, so it's good data then.
I think so. You'll have your speaker card opportunity. Any more question at this time on this particular item? Okay. Since we do have other items under the this informational item, I certainly encourage member of the public, to have speaker card, and then when we'll have heard all the speakers, they'll give you an opportunity to comment further on this item. So thank you, Dr. Hunter.
I want to get a clarification on when public questions or public time at the podium will be given. Given that we have a noon deadline today when this hearing will end, will we allow for people who are here today and who may not be here tomorrow to have time for questions, even though this item is being continued?
Yeah, that was part of the plan.
Okay, very good.
All right, thank you very much. So, Mr. Robertson, if you can introduce the next speaker.
She is going to have Chris Rose introduce the next speaker. Thank you, Chris.
Dr. Danglin, could you step forward and present for us? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. And thank Mary and Chris for inviting us speaking today at the board meeting. So my name is Xin Dan. And I'm a senior environmental scientist from Surface Water Protection Program at DPR. So today I will be talking about the current pesticide occurrence and the trends in the surface water of the Central Coast. Basically, I will be sharing the monitoring data that have been collected in this area from 2011 to 2016 through our ag monitoring program. I'll be focusing on insect sites today because they are the ones of most concerns. Just a brief introduction of our monitoring program. The Ag Monitoring Program is a long-term monitoring program. As you mentioned, we typically target on worst case scenario. For Ag monitoring, we typically monitor in high production areas with row crops because those areas tend to use high amount of pesticides and irrigation practices tend to generate high pesticide runoff. Historically, we have seen higher detections and concentration in various of pesticides. Can I use a point? It's going. Can we use, is there a pointer on this? Let's see. All right. Anyway. Oh. No wonder it goes backwards. Sorry. Anyway, so this map marks those our current monitoring areas: Salinas, Santa Maria, Imperial, our long-term monitoring areas. We have been stopping in those regions for last 10 years. We extended our monitoring region to the rice country last year in Sacramento Valley. The general objectives of our project are to determine occurrence of pesticides in surface waters, to evaluate spatial and temporal trend in detection frequencies and concentrations, and finally to evaluate the potential risk of detected concentrations to aquatic organisms. The Central Coast region is the centerpiece of our monitoring program. Over 80% of our samples have been collected in this area. During 2011 to 2016, we have been sampled in at 12 sites in Salinas Valley, 8 sites in Santa Maria. So Salinas River, Tumbadora Slough, Oka Creek, also Flat Creek, those are our long-term monitoring watershed. We temporarily sampled at Old Salinas River, Main Street Ditch, and Bradley Channel. Bradley Channel is one of the new sites we ended last year because it's associated with a woodchip bioreactor. We want to get some background information. Our sampling schedule is primarily based on the pesticide use annual use cycle. This graph shows the patterns of the year use for a few representative pesticides. Typically, you will see the use is start increasing around March and keep increasing to the peak around July, August. And after that, it goes down sharply. And around November, you will see it's reached the, about reached the bottom. So it's repeated again next year, March, you know, so on and so forth. So our sampling schedule then was scheduled between April to September to catch the high, you know, runoff period. In Salinas, we sample monthly, six times of a year. And in Santa Maria, we sample every other month in May, July, and September. Those are the insect sites, 17 of them, we regularly monitored and recommended by our model. They belong to six chemical groups. Mostly we have OPs, five OPs, two carbamates, one neonicotinoids we are working on, and more of them because we know there are more of them getting used and other groups and being detected in high frequencies. So there are six pyrethroids and carbon dioxide hydrogens, and this is chemical mentioned by Rizzo and requested by Regin. Three, and there are found fairly high detections in our monitoring program, but they are not. This one is not, you know, highly toxic. So. Chloratronidipro is the one we started regular monitor for. One of the ways we evaluate our monitoring result is to compare the concentrations to the lowest US EPA aquatic life benchmarks. This table listed those compounds we're going to focus on today, imidacloprid and six pyrethroids. So the lowest benchmark happened to be the chronic benchmarks for invertebrates. Their preferred level is in low PPT level. And the US EPA just updated the imidacloprid by the end of last year, and now the value is like 100 times lower than the previous value. These two graphs summarizes the detection frequencies and exceedances for the commonly detected pesticides. We have 30 of them in Salinas, 10 of them in Santa Maria. They're pretty similar. There are a few couple compounds are not here. In general, you will see, for most of the chemicals, you will see higher detections and exceedances in Salinas, except malathion and imidacloprid, which are higher in Santa Maria. So for the next rest of my talk, I'm going to do a comparison of detections between those two areas for OPs, methanol, and imidacloprid. In the case of pyrethroids, the detections are not, you know, super high. It's actually very low for most of it in Santa Maria. So I'm going to focus on the data set in Salinas. Now let's start with the OPs, chlorpyrifos. Wants to be hot topic. Now you will see the detections has a significant downtrend for both areas. In 2016, we only have 3% detections. In Santa Maria, the situation is better. We haven't detected any of those since 2013. So zero detections. Similarly to diazinol, we have to say significantly downtrend over the years in Salinas. We have zero detections in the 3 years of the data set. Then we stop monitoring for this, for diazinol in Santa Maria. Malathion, there's no temporal trend over the years. It's pretty consistent in Salinas. It's fluctuated quite a bit in Santa Maria. But you do see higher detection frequencies in average overall in Santa Maria. Methanol, there's no trend we can see, but we see really, you know, consistent high detections in Salinas. These are the use amount where data from PUR for the OPs and the methanol in the Central Coast. And you can see for all the OPs, malathion, chlorpyrifos, diazinol, dimethyl, those are major OPs that have been used in this area. They have a downtrend for all of them. Well, dimethyl has been slowly going down. And we see, you know, sharp downtrend for those two. And after 2011, we see there's a big reduction between 2011 and 2012 for malathion. The only chemical we see uptrend is methanol. And there was about 50% increase between 2014 and 2015. You can see 26, the PUR data in 2016 are not available right now. So then I pull up the county use data for the three counties that we have been monitoring. We see in general the methanol use increase between 2014 to 2015. Slight increase in San Luis Obispo, about 50% increase in Santa Barbara, And we see a sharp increase, about 30-40% increase in Mount Torrey. So the most of the use increase in Central Coast contributed from, looks like contributed from Mount Torrey. So just summarize, I have in the last few slides, we have see a significant temporal downtrends for chloroprophores and diazinals in uses and their detection frequencies. There was no temporal trends observed for malathion and methamphetamine detection frequencies. Malathion detection frequencies are significantly higher in Santa Maria, whereas methamphetamine has significantly higher uses detection frequencies and uses in Salinas. So move on to imidacloprid, the neonicotinoid. Overall, the detections are really high, from 70% to 100%. As note, we see that they're pretty consistent over the years. There is significant higher years in Santa Maria, but from 2014 to 2013, we see 100% detection in all of our samples. This graph shows the exceedances between the two areas in three different benchmarks. 1.05 ppb is the old noise to chronic benchmark from EPA. 0.385 ppb is the current lowest acute benchmark. And 0.01 ppb is the lowest current lowest chronic benchmark for this compound. In all the cases, you will see the detections in Santa Maria are significantly higher than in those in Salinas. And as the standard getting more stringent, then you will get higher exceedances. This graph shows the use over the years for these three counties that we have been monitored. In Monterey, we see about 20% of fluctuations over the years, pretty consistent. In Santa Barbara, we see consistent increase, about 30% increase, dropped a little bit in last in 2015. And we see pretty good increase in St. Louis Obispo. About, it's hard to tell, about 50% increase, maybe 40%. And here are some, physical chemical properties for this compound. It's extremely water soluble with low KOW, and its half-life compared a lot of compounds are fairly persistent, 129 days. So to summarize, imidacloprid has been widely detected in this region with no significant temporal trends. We have seen higher detections for these compounds, and now there are higher percent of exceedances due to the recent change of US EPA benchmarks. Other detections and exceedances are significantly higher in Santa Maria than those in Salinas. Most likely, the reasons of the high detections are caused by high water solubility, persistence, and their constant high use. So move on to pyrethroids. This graph just summarizes the detection frequencies over the years for the three highly detected pyrethroids. There's no trend we can tell, but all of them fluctuate over the years. Some years are higher than the other years. This graph just the pool data for for those years for detection frequencies. We see, you can see, bifenthrin has the highest detection frequencies and 75%, followed by permethrin and 37%. The lowest detection frequency is lambda-cyclamothrin. This graph just shows the use data for those three compounds in Monterey County. It's not exactly the Salinas watershed use, but it's pretty close because, you know, Salinas Valley use most of it in the county. So you can see permethrin has about 7 to 6 times higher use in this region. But back to the detection. We actually have highest detection from bifenthrin. Bifenthrin, actually, the use is actually the average, is the lowest among the three. Here are some of the physical properties to give us some reasoning of why we see this. We see bifenthrin has the lowest solubility, water solubility, fairly high KOC, twice, about 2.6 times higher than permethrin. By the way, KOC is a partition coefficient, right? The higher it is, the hydrophobic the K compound is. And it's fairly persistent compared to those two, 260 days. A quick summary of what we have seen. So once we see no temporal trend on detection frequencies in any of the pyrethroids, because probably, most likely due to their consistent widespread use, but bifenthrin has the highest detection frequencies despite their low use, low use to average use, but most likely due to their high persistence and KOC. Now we have our monitoring data for over the years. Currently, I'm working with my coworkers to look into the PUR data and analyze for use patterns and watershed level. We also want to do some site-specific analysis in attempt to link the monitoring data to POR, to the use data, and to land use, hydrology, and other, you know, parameters. So our monitoring data has a lot of utilities. You know, one is keep us informed on the issues in the field. Another is we use the data to guide us to allocate our limited resources. Right now, we have supported several research mitigation research projects. One of them is to looking at the microbial mediations of pesticides in wood chip bioreactors. The lab, the professor, Dr. Anin Hafa, is the project lead. And also we support another project to look at the molecular biomarkers for colorectal linipro and the imidacloprid, because those two compounds have high detections. They most likely occur in the water. We also supported a couple of other mitigation projects in the Central Coast. We funded Dr. Anderson and Phillips' project looking at to evaluate the integrated vegetative system on pesticides mitigations in temperature slough. We really like this project. It's a field experiment to looking at the, you know, vegetated treatment system for mitigating imidacloprid and permethrin. It leaves a submit a proposal to Leafy Green Group, a research institute. I haven't heard back from Brian yet. Wood chip bioreactors have been supported, get a well support from the water board. So they're designed for nitrate removal, but we like to see how that biobank can do with pesticide runoff. So we have been involved at least four of them in the Central Coast. We like to get samples in and out to see how efficient they are. So we have been regularly communicate our data with registry scientists to help them identify the hotspot. Mary, have you had to asking for updates on their chemical list or ACPO 4.0? Yeah, we're helping on that. So, that's for this coming years, we're looking for more research projects based on our monitoring results. But this is another one. There's another example. We're working with UC Davis lab, looking at the pesticide removal efficiencies in this multi-channel system. It has been built in a cluster veil. With that, I guess I'm going to stop here, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
I'll start on my right.
Thank you, Dr. Wolf, and thank you for the presentation. I'm just curious I'm intrigued by the concept of some of these bioreactors, wood chip. I know there's been some other methodologies talked about that have been directed at nitrates and their effectiveness on pesticide. I like the idea of a 2-for-1. Do you have any preliminary results or any sense of what you're seeing on that?
We started last year, and there's some very limited samples. We cannot draw any conclusions because at those times the bioreactors were not stable. Our sampling timing is a bit off. We don't know, but at that time we don't know the exact retention time. So the result is kind of awkward. Could be we get a little higher detection than outlet than inlet at one point for one compound. But it's sampled at the same time, in and out. So it's hard to too soon to conclude. Yeah, I think brain may have more data than we do. Yeah.
On my left, Mayor Delgado.
Yes, thank you. Can you go to the detections by year of the methomyl or methomyl? So there it looks fairly consistent, at least in the Salinas area, right? No,
yes.
No big changes there.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go to the next slide showing detections. There is a big change in 2015 for methomyl, which is the second group from the left. So my question is, why such a large percentage of detection increase in 2015, that bar to the furthest right in the methomyl group, but yet in the previous slide, there's no big difference.
Yeah, right, I understand. Well, this is a chart I just put out last week to prepare this presentation. I need to dig back into the data set a little bit more, see which area has been increased, how it's going to associate with our sampling site. So I don't have a full answer to you at this point. We're looking into it.
Okay,
and
but do you agree that there's
some of our colleagues actually raised the doubt about the data because oftentimes we have false report and PUR. But in this case, I'd rather believe it because look at the decrease of the OPs. And it seems reasonable to me to see increase in other compounds, use of the other compound. So we still need to dug into the data to see what happened.
So does different sampling drive those two different graphs, or is it the same?
No, this is a use that's completely separate to our monitoring data. It's just there is correlation between the use and the monitoring data.
So in this case, they seem to be inconsistent. The
reported
use is up, but the detections are...
That doesn't change much. Yeah, it could attribute to maybe our monitoring area doesn't capture the high use area, or maybe these compounds' physical equipment properties, they degrade pretty quickly, even they get a high use. Or maybe the area has improved the irrigation system as certain crop uses.
Right.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So the use can be high and the detections could be low because of best management practices.
Right, right.
Got it.
So, and this will be, yeah, that's a good sign. You know, big ingress doesn't really directly lead to high detections, high concentrations.
Okay. I have one other question. When you go to the slide about Dr. Arlene Hoffa at CSU Monterey Bay, the mitigation research slide, and it says developing molecular biomarkers to assess the chloramphenicol and imidacloprid impacts in aquatic species. So my question is, how does the wood chip bioreactor project have anything to do with impacts in aquatic species? I thought it was a process where dirty comes in, hopefully clean comes out, and you see
the
effect.
You mean the first one, wood chip bioreactor?
Yeah.
They identify microbials which can be more efficient to degrade pesticides. The intention is they will build up the string, inoculate the bioreactor to improve the efficiency, if we can achieve the goal.
Okay,
this
so
is a research project.
Okay, so the research project is studying the ability of the wood chip bioreactors to filter out the pollutants, right? And so there's an assumption that if you filter out the pollutants, you reduce the impacts to aquatic species.
Yes.
So it's not testing the impacts on aquatic species, it's testing the efficacy of the...
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, because most of those are on drain tiles and drain ditch where you try to capture that water before it gets into... blue line streams. Mary, did you have something to add? You want to do that now? Oh, okay.
Thank you.
But maybe you want to supplement something. So, Jane?
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. It's a lot to digest, but it's very comprehensive. So I just had a quick question for clarification. On the data assessment slide. So there's currently a linkage between the PUR data and parameters, or there's no linkage and you still have to make those linkages?
There's no linkage.
There is
you have to make it.
Okay.
It's not easy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty critical, though.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's, we're still sorting out the data, see what we can really link it. Put some other parameters into our analytical analysis model.
Right. It would seem to be helpful to have those parameters embedded within the model itself.
Yeah.
Maybe
we can. Maybe, we don't see any correlations.
Okay.
We're still experimenting.
Okay. Thank you.
So I have, couple of quick items before our next speaker, and also just I want to make sure we'll leave 20 minutes at the end before noon to give opportunity for speaker cards and further clarification that may be prompted by their questions. So just if you can help me stay on track for that, I'll appreciate it. So one item is in some of our research. You talked about different projects there, but a few years ago, we had some interesting research done on the vegetative strips as buffer and certain type of grasses which have the ability of also
I'm going to use the wrong term perhaps, but metabolize or capture, better choice of word, capture some types of pesticides. So is there any more work done in that area?
I think Brian is the best person to answer the question because he done the work.
Okay, all right. So
we collaborate, but
all right. So we'll get that. The other item, and it gets back to the fact that I think if we take pesticide application and we translate it into pounds per year use, which actually is tons per year, you know, if we take the aggregate for the state, there are a lot of variables. I cited earlier climate change, but certain class of pesticides, if we see an increase in a particular year, that is not necessarily because on a per acre base there is an increase. It's perhaps because in this particular crop that year we have increased that crop by 20%. Hence, the use is going to increase. So that's one, it's acreage. The other one is the type of crop. There are certain crops that have higher pesticide input needs than others. So I don't know if that's done, but I think it would really help giving a better understanding when we use the term best management practice, basically on, you know, correlating things back to on a per acre base and per crop type. And that way we get a handle on these, you know, variations we have from year to year on certain crops that, you know, become, okay, this is high commodity crop and we increase the amount of acres. Strawberries is an example where, you know, a few years ago you had almost doubling of the acreage in the Central Coast. Well, along with that goes, you know, a suite of pesticides application. So is there such a thing that is DPR you're working on, or you're saying, well, you know, that's more in the world of CDFA?
I agree with all your comments. And we are right now we're analyzing PR data. That's what the next stage for use patterns and such and so on and so forth. We're focused on pyrethroids and the immediate carbide of those two compounds right now.
Yeah. Okay.
We will have more information.
For sure. Stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned.
All right. Well, you know, all of this is always is work in progress.
Right.
So thank you very much. I appreciate also, you know, the detail of your presentation. You know, good information. Keep up the good work. And Mr. Robertson, should we take a break? So let's take a 15-minute break, and we can reconvene at 10 to 11. That would be fantastic. Thank you.